Dr. David Chapman. David earned his PhD in pharmacology and toxicology at the University of Utah in 2003, where he began his career in neuroscience research studying the interaction of the NMDA and D1 dopamine receptors in the context of methamphetamine treatment. He continued to study this interaction in a mouse model of schizophrenia and sleep disorders as a postdoc at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center in the Department of Psychiatry. After his postdoctoral fellowship, Dave joined the biopharmaceutical company UCB as a CNS medical science liaison, where he focused on diseases such as epilepsy and Parkinson's disease. Early this year, Dr. Chapman joined Ameritox, where he serves as Assistant Director of Medical Science and Health Outcomes Research. And Dave, I'll hand it over to you.
Thank you much. Welcome to the postprandial afternoon session here. Hope we can keep things lively for you. I want to touch base a little bit on, first of all, what a medical science liaison is. When I was in graduate school and through most of my postdoc time, I really had no idea. So I just want to make sure that you're aware of what some of those options are.
Sorry.
Function. It is ready to go. You just have to arrow over. This person review.
Oh. Very well. Sorry about that. We'll now continue. okay, so this is a bunch of flowery language, but the bottom line is, as a medical science liaison, your currency is going to be information. So regardless of if it's going to an external customer or to an internal partner, the main thing and the main value that you're going to provide is being able to work with the currency of information. So it's either going to be disease state related, it's going to be product specific, it's going to be what are some of the challenges that physicians currently see in trying to treat disorder X, Y, or Z, and then it's bringing that information back in-house so that hopefully either from a strategic or, more importantly, from a development standpoint, how can we best address those needs and those concerns? From an internal perspective, it's being able to sort of marry some of the stories that maybe are going on from a sales and marketing perspective and being able to evaluate whether those resonate with physicians and whether just to ensure that the end goals of the company mirror the needs of the physician. So in terms of qualifications, an advanced degree currently is required. There are still probably a handful of nurses who are medical science liaisons who have had a number of years of experience and have kind of been grandfathered into the position. I guess this is the part where you ask postdoc, yes, no. While it's not explicitly required to have postdoctoral training, my take on it, so I was a postdoc for 2 years. When I graduated from grad school, I had 3 kids. We had a single grad student salary, if you can call it that, transitioned to a postdoc salary. And so a family of 5 on a postdoc salary doesn't really work out terribly well. So I was there for 2 years. I felt like that was a fair amount of time, and I'm grateful for that opportunity that I had to be a postdoc. Certainly there were some challenges and some sacrifices that were made, but again, just the ability that you get to think critically and to evaluate things are, as has kind of been a common theme throughout many of these discussions, it's something which will only benefit you in the career that you choose in MSL is no different there. The last bullet point, the ability to travel. So one of the blessings and the curses of this position is it's generally a field-based position. So I live in St. Louis. When I was with UCB, their U.S. headquarters was in Atlanta. Now that I'm with Emeritox, their headquarters is in Baltimore. We do a lot of teleconferences from an internal perspective. And then generally, you will have a team. It could be a team of two, which is what I started with Emeritox. It could be a team of 25, which is what we were working with at UCB. But generally, you would have a carved-out portion of the country in which you would again, sort of use that information exchange with physicians and the company. So it is imperative that you're comfortable traveling, and sometimes that means, you know, going out Saturday or Sunday afternoon. Sometimes that means to start early Monday morning. Sometimes that means not getting back until very late Friday evening. In terms of the history of the MSL, and it almost seems like, in a way, we'll discuss this in a bit, but it seems like we're kind of coming full circle. But back in the late 60s, Upjohn was one of the first groups that kind of realized that there needs to be an additional level of training and ability to communicate with physicians that generally sales representatives didn't possess. And so they came up with this medical science liaison. Other terms are regional scientific managers. Generally, the objectives are similar of these types of groups. But the thought was to engage on a higher scientific level with these physicians. And in general, they were what are considered key physicians. So they're physicians that then influence other physicians. So it's by speaking at national and international scientific meetings. It's in some cases speaking on behalf of a pharmaceutical or medical device company, but they then sort of have this influence over physicians who are also in that community. And it could be a community geographically, or it could be community meaning society level. And initially, the medical science liaison reported into sales and marketing. That doesn't happen today for a number of legal reasons, and also just, again, for that ability to speak at a, at a medical type of level. And needless to say, this group was successful, and so they expanded their team based on that success. So the main objectives, again, kind of the underlying thread through all of this is just being able to use information and convey that information or to bring that information back. But first of all, develop relationships with individuals who are critical for shaping healthcare within a given geography or within a given sphere. And generally, that needs to be through peer-to-peer contact. Sometimes it can be through much larger formats, such as this. Sometimes it's through presentations to state Medicaid, who will then review, I guess, the merits, the clinical merits of your product. So the next bullet point, there are types of studies called investigator-initiated studies or investigator-initiated trials. And what these are, generally they don't serve as means of of getting FDA approval. Rather, what they, at least historically, what they've done is they've given the company a signal. So, for example, the disease state that I worked in for the most of the previous 5 years was epilepsy. As soon as a new anticonvulsant makes it to market and is deemed safe and effective there, there will be a handful of physicians, typically psychiatrists and things of that nature, who have patient populations whose needs are very largely unmet. such as schizophrenia, such as bipolar, maybe it's chronic pain. And they will immediately take these medicines, which again are deemed at least safe, and will say, okay, this particular patient has no other option. Why don't we go ahead and try, you know, this new molecule in them and see what what the outcomes are. And so a lot of these investigator-initiated studies or trials, sometimes they're even open-label studies, but they're just a means of trying to get a signal. Is this drug going to be effective for a particular type of patient whose need is largely unmet? Currently, there's a little bit more, I guess, at least the experience that I've seen is it's become a lot more conservative. So there are some companies, individuals who will believe that this might be deemed as inducement. So again, when you get FDA approval for a certain condition or for treatment of a certain condition, it should be used in that narrowly defined sphere, and it shouldn't be necessarily extended to some of these off-label things. In the event that it is, sales representatives and representatives from the company cannot actively promote that that type of use. So the next thing, it's important that we're seen as peers. Again, that kind of goes back to why an advanced professional or scientific degree is required for this position. But it's a hope that we're consultants with physicians and how they deem best to treat their patients. And lastly, both within the company and then outside, we provide scientific and educational support. So this little Venn diagram certainly isn't drawn to scale, but the thing that I guess I'd like to bring up with this is a medical science liaison has a pivotal role in a number of different aspects of pharmaceutical or medical device or diagnostic type of company. And so if you don't necessarily know where you want to end up, a medical science liaison is a spectacular starting point, simply because it allows you to get a taste or a little bit of flavor for a number of different types of functions within the company. Let's see. I guess the one thing I want to focus on is managed markets. So this is managed markets basically is if you get an FDA approval for a drug, then that at least gets it to the ballpark. Managed markets is important in discussing the clinical value of a compound and how it relates to some of the molecules that have come before it. So they discuss with insurance companies the merit of taking on your particular drug. And the medical science liaison role there is to provide the clinical perspective and the that scientific information so that they can make hopefully a well-informed clinical decision and not one that's based solely on cost of drug. So this is my I don't know if anybody is NMDA receptor people out here, but during graduate school I was largely influenced by Mark Baer and his sliding threshold of synaptic plasticity or metaplasticity of synaptic plasticity. And basically, there's this sliding threshold of the medical science liaison. On the, let's see, on your left side, there's the purest just delivery of scientific information. And then on the other end of that spectrum is one which is totally driven on sales. The medical science liaison needs to be somewhere in the middle of that. And there are a number of different variables which can get you further oriented, I guess, on closer to the science side or closer to the sales side. Some of those variables include company culture. One example is There are some companies that are so conservative that they don't want their sales team and their medical team to ever have any sort of communication with one another. The thought, again, being that they don't want to have any sort of view that there might be an inducement for some sort of off-label promotion of a product. So that would keep your medical science liaison team much more aligned on the scientific side. Another possibility is product life cycle. And what happens there is initially, generally, you'd like to have a medical science liaison team, or at least a small team, available 18 months before a product is launched. So before a product is launched, there is no sales force. You're not able to go out and to discuss that because you don't yet have FDA approval for any sort of product. But what you can do is engage in scientific discussions, again, be it disease state, be it how would a drug that has some of these types of properties, how would that be able to help or not help you in treating particular patients, and by at least discussing some of the work leading up to submission, it allows for, again, those key influential physicians then to go out and to speak. Something coming down the pipeline is this particular product. These are some of the potential pluses versus others. However, as the product life cycle matures, as the drug has been on the market and there are only 6 months before patent expiry, then you may move from this education type of role to one in which all of that education has already been accomplished. The last thing, which I think kind of fits into this, is trends in pharmaceutical industry in general. And we'll actually talk about that on the next slide as well. But one of the trends, at least that I see, so this is all, Chapman stuff, not necessarily what's doctrine, but what I kind of see is that the overall value of the sales representative is decreasing. And as that sales representative physician relationship continues to become devalued, one of the things that is, I guess, at least intriguing for pharmaceutical companies to do is to go ahead and to try and plug in an MSL for that spot. I'm a little bit wary of that. The pluses are there would be considerably more medical science liaison positions. The downsides would be it would align itself a whole lot more on the sales side of this spectrum. And I guess my two cents on it would be that we would then go down the potential slippery slope of devaluing the medical science liaison physician interaction. So the data that existed in 2008 was a typical sales representative physician interaction lasted about a minute and a half, and that was generally for signature for samples and maybe getting in three other words edgewise. For a medical science liaison physician interaction, those averaged about 45 minutes. And so you can't have it both ways, where you increase the number of MSLs and maintain that value and integrity of the relationship. I don't know if, so I try and avoid going to see physicians for, any personal reasons, but probably 5 years ago I went in because I had to get something taken care of for my eye. And I was blown away. It had been probably the first time in 6 or 7 years that I had been in a physician's office, but it was a revolving door. There were either sales representatives back in trying to speak to the physician, or there were two waiting. And if somebody would come in, the next one would go out, and that was kind of how it worked. And, from a consumer perspective, it was a little bit frustrating because I just as soon not wait the 45 minutes to see the physician. So the state of the industry, this is the $864 kajillion dollar question. The first thing, Public Law 111-148, which is Bill H.R. 3590 or healthcare reform. What is that going to do? Pharma trends, we've just kind of got done discussing medical device and genetic laboratories. I'd just like to kind of lump those together because they recently have been lumped together. In the past, genetic laboratories did not need to show clinical benefit in order to get their products on the market. That's recently been changed so that they're now treated more like medical device companies where they need to have, so they're evaluated by the FDA and they need to have trials which explicitly state by doing this genetic test, you're going to improve patient care. So one of the biggest examples of this, I guess, is at least for me, is a Salt Lake City-based company called Myriad Genetics that cloned BRCA1, BRCA2. And again, in the past, they've only had to show that, you know, they can test and they can reliably show, you know, that they have low false positives and false negatives. Now they need to show that by showing that an individual has this gene, it will be important for the patient's care. And then diagnostic laboratories, again, this has largely been untouched, but it's something which is currently being evaluated by the FDA. So I want to take 14 seconds as far as a means of trying to get your foot in the door if you're interested in a medical science liaison. The outsourced MSL, so this is a contract organization which then makes a bid, and usually they're a yearly basis with companies to be that MSL team. The bottom line, it says provide the same function as internal teams. While that's true from a points on paper standpoint, I don't think it shows to the physician that the company is as vested in staying in that disease state. And again, to my opinion, you'll get a less rich interaction with physicians and a contracted MSL team. That said, it's a great way to get your foot in the door and to be able to kind of embark on first endeavors as an MSL. Lastly, these are just some of the resources that I used to put this together. Jane Chin runs what's called the MSL Institute, available online. She was an MSL and felt that there were not enough means for MSLs to sort of talk out or speak out against being used as kind of super sales representatives. And so, there's a wealth of information there, and I appreciate your time. So thank you very much.